Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, entertaining, and here to give you tips to make your life easier and the lives of your friends and family. Today, my special guest is Dr. Carol Mayhew, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about her. She's a psychologist, marriage and family therapist, and contemporary psychoanalyst in private practice in Brentwood, California. In her work, she combines her understanding of trauma, attachment, disassociation, and other contemporary psychodynamic ideas to help people to better understand themselves and to grow in the ways they desire. Dr. Mayhew offers consultation to other therapists, and she has taught and given presentations locally, nationally, and internationally. And today, the theme of our show is on trauma and attachment. Welcome, Dr. Mayhew.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you, what is your definition of trauma?
Well, I think trauma is a really interesting topic because I think when we just think of trauma off the top of our heads, we think of big catastrophic events like the typhoon in the Philippines, for example, or earthquakes, or the terrible kinds of mass shootings and so on that we see in the news so often. But I think when we think more about it, there are many, 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 many different kinds of traumatic events that happen. And I think it's important to acknowledge them. So, I mean, we could just go on and on. But for example, things like bullying, losing a job, serious illness, divorce, war, child abuse, violent crime, domestic violence, car accidents. I mean, the list can go on and on. And it's important to recognize, I think, that those kinds of traumas, each kind of trauma has its own aftermath, lives with people in its own particular kind of way, and everyone is different. In addition, there's also what we call little t trauma, which is which has to do with emotional trauma, basically. And it has often to do with the kind of chronic, ongoing interaction patterns that we experience as children and then grow up to carry with us, maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously, that then guides our expectations about ourselves and others. So for examples of this might be, for example, emotional neglect, where a child's needs, physical needs are met, and sometimes it looks like it's just a fine family. And yet at the same time, this child's actual experience isn't being paid attention to. This child's growing up with nobody really recognizing his or her feelings. So someone like that often arrives at adulthood thinking, what's wrong with me? Why aren't I happy? I come from a fine family. Everything was fine. Without really understanding what was missing, because it's hard to identify what's missing.
So it sounds like something that might not, an experience that might be really negative, and a person's not quite registering it as trauma because they figure, well, it's not that big of a deal, and they kind of bypass all the feelings and put it into denial. Is that correct?
I think that's true. Often it's hard for us to, especially when it's so close to us that it feels like part of who we are, it can be hard to recognize what was really traumatic, especially when it's ongoing and a constant part of one's environment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I know with like moderate to severe traumas, there is a component of what's called disassociation. Can you explain about that?
Well, sure. One of the things with dissociation is a way that people block something out of awareness. And what is blocked out of awareness may be enormous. So, for example, we have all probably heard the stories of people who have been child abuse, especially child sexual abuse survivors, who don't really realize their histories until something triggers them in adulthood. So that's an example of massive dissociation, where the entire set of experiences are basically unknown to the person until they're not. And other examples of dissociation, however, may be more specific. So, for example, somebody may remember something traumatic that happened, but have no feelings about it. An example is a man I worked with had been beaten frequently, often as a child, and had no feelings at all about it until one day he saw on the sidewalk a father harshly reprimanding his son, and suddenly he could feel for that little boy that he didn't even know all the feelings he'd never been able to feel for himself. So that's an example of dissociation, dissociating, knowing what happened, but dissociating the feelings. Another example is having the feelings and not knowing what happened. So sometimes people will have tremendous fear reactions or upset reactions and not really realize why those reactions are occurring, because what may be triggering them might be unknown. This happens actually sometimes, even when people know that they've been traumatized, they may not connect their feeling reaction with the traumatic experience. As an example, I worked with a woman who'd been in a vehicle that was struck by a train, and she was severely injured. She was in a coma for months, but luckily, amazingly, she recovered. And she was walking to my office, and actually she arrived at my office in a terrible state. Her heart was pounding, she was perspiring, and she was so anxious. She was overwhelmed, and she thought she was going crazy. And I asked her when these feelings, these symptoms began, and she said, well, I was walking to your office, and I was crossing some train tracks, and there were some old defunct train tracks embedded in the cement somewhere on the way to my office. And what was interesting was that even though she knew she'd been in this terrible, terrible train accident, it didn't occur to her until that moment to connect the train tracks with her reaction. So it can be very helpful for people to realize that there's a connection somewhere, even if it isn't immediately known.
Yeah, and I would imagine in a situation like that also, where the dots are not connected with the person that is almost re-experiencing the trauma, that they can feel like they're being overwhelmed or confused or going crazy. They have no idea what's going on. So can you explain a little bit about what can possibly be happening in somebody's brain during a process like that? Because I know traumatic events can mess with the chemicals that are processing in the brain.
Well, that's true. One of the things with all the amazing brain research that's going on right now, one of the things that happens in a situation of high trauma is our brains release cortisol, which is a stress hormone, or a stress neurotransmitter. It in turn suppresses the functioning of the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is the brain region that helps us translate, I'm putting this in very lay language, helps us translate sensory, motor, emotional experiences into narrative, into the story of what happened. And when the hypothesis is that in extremely stressful circumstances, it may happen that the high levels of cortisol are interfering with that hippocampal functioning, which then means the experience is stored essentially in our memory, but it's not stored as narrative. So we can't remember what happened. We don't have a story to tell. But we have what is stored is the sensory impressions, the body experiences, the emotional experiences, and this is how it can feel so unaccountable when suddenly something kind of erupts, either emotionally or even in a sensory flashback or in a nightmare, sometimes in a whole body experience, like an unaccountable body pain, for example, that seems to have no connection to anything, but it really is, you know, it's stored in our neurons, essentially, but it's not yet converted into narrative. In therapy, it's possible then to start to kind of follow these memory strands and begin to put together more of a story of what happened, which then allows it to come into the realm of more ordinary kinds of memory.
So basically, the person who's experiencing this doesn't have control over the memories being processed in the here and now. The and like you said, Dr. Mayhew, it's that something in the environment triggers a person to remember all of a sudden or be right back in the past experiencing all this so that they can start processing out the trauma and start healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and one of the reasons it is important to understand the traumatic experiences and what they have, you know, how they sit in one's psyche is to begin to understand the triggering that happens. Because often what can happen is these things can get triggered by all kinds of unexpected experiences. Everybody knows how triggering smell can be of all sorts of memories. So a scent can really set off a lot of memory in one direction or another. Sounds, for example, I mean, we hear stories of Vietnam veterans who, if they hear a helicopter, go into a complete flashback. That's another example. Sometimes particular sites, like the example of the railroad tracks. So all of these, and then there's the emotional triggering, and I think this is important to understand, too. So if somebody, well, let me just give you an example. A man I worked with had been assaulted and almost killed, really. He barely escaped with his life. What happened afterwards for him as a, you know, during the long recovery, because he was extraordinarily traumatized by this, understandably, but one of the things that happened was as soon as he even felt his self-esteem to be at risk, he would immediately feel his entire person go into fight or flight mode, basically. He was sort of ready for battle instantly, even if there was sort of just a vague threat to his self-esteem, not even to his physical self. And so this is an example of a physical trauma, but the being activated in the emotional realm. When we have emotional trauma, it's most frequently activated in the emotional realm, right? So, for example, let's take somebody who is raised with, say, constant criticism of everything. It's never good enough. It's never right. And let's imagine that this person is always being told that he or she is stupid. Well, so what happens for that person then, what's activating is anything that's challenging intelligence, if that was the primary message. So, you know, a test or being required to speak in front of others or being asked a question, all of these things can be basically emotional triggers for a whole patterning of unconscious ideas about who they are in the world and what they expect of themselves and others.
And then they start acting out and behaving from all of those messages that they were given.
Exactly, exactly. So they behave in accordance with the expectations they have. So they think, well, yes, I must be stupid, because otherwise why would I be told that all the time? And therefore, number one, they freak out and get all silent in any kind of occasion where they're being asked to demonstrate anything of how they think. And so people don't you know, people may take them as somebody who doesn't have a lot to say and then treat them accordingly. And therefore, then that just confirms their feeling that they're stupid. And you can see how this can become a lockdown pattern as time goes by that doesn't, you know, there are no windows there to show a different reality.
Yeah, until something comes in and intervenes and gets in the way and saying, you know, let's challenge whatever I'm thinking about myself. Let's challenge those messages. They're wrong. They need to be replaced. They, you know, it does happen, but sometimes it's a slow process. And with a lot of people, it doesn't happen at all, which is sad. But I would like to ask you about how attachment fits into all of this.
Well, attachment is important in a couple ways. First of all, attachment can make a big difference with trauma, both positively and negatively. So one of the things about trauma, I mean, if we think about, well, what exactly is trauma? How do we define what's traumatic? What's traumatic for one person may not look so traumatic for the other one. Mm-hmm. What makes the difference? Well, the difference is really in the experience of the beholder, right? It's in the experience of unbearable emotion. And if there's another person there that the person can turn to for comfort, for help, or even just understanding, that can often make a huge difference in whether it becomes re-traumatizing and re-traumatizing and re-traumatizing, or whether it's a traumatic thing that happened and now it's over and it's a memory. And so in that way, attachment connection can really help with trauma in a very big way. And even after the fact, I mean, this is one of the things that happens in therapy, is that having someone there who really will listen to what happened and be with the person with all of those terrible feelings can change how that event is remembered and can change the entire picture, because now there's an attachment person in the picture.
Yeah, who's caring and compassionate.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, problematic attachment can also, or lack of attachment, lack of somebody there, can make things much worse. For example, I was working with a man who'd been assaulted, a different man who'd been assaulted, and I asked him what was the worst moment, and he said the worst moment was when I called 911 and the line was busy.
Oh.
That's an example of how essential it feels to be able to reach out for help when one needs it. Conversely, I also know of someone who was in a terrible situation where somebody was shooting people, and she was hiding, and she called 911 on her phone, and all during this very traumatic time, she was able to be in touch with this 911 person, and that made all the difference in terms of how that traumatic event was for her, because the ability to have somebody there helping her, give her guidance and be with her, made a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, I would imagine just having a calm person on the other end, walking her through and mm-hmm. just saying, hey, help is on the way. And I would imagine that would make all the difference, most definitely. Yeah. We are going to take a commercial break right now. I want to come back and talk about the basics of attachment. Okay? Thank you, Dr. Mayhew. Mm-hmm.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses, Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School for sponsoring Psych 1-on-1. And the listeners, if you cannot listen to this whole podcast or you would like to come back to it later, this is available on skidrowstudios.com. We are also on the iTunes Store at Psych 1-on-1. That's P-S-Y-C-H, the number 1, O-N, and another number 1. And we're also on Facebook and Stitcher. And we have a whole library of Psych 1-on-1 topics from the past, about 25, 30 shows right now. So Dr. Mayhew, I'd like to come back and talk to you about the basics of attachment.
Mm-hmm. Well, attachment is, it was sort of originally spoken about by a man in England named John Bowlby. And what he was noticing was this, and this was like in the 50s, and if you remember, many children in England were taken away from London to avoid the bombings of World War II and were stationed in the countryside, but in the process they were separated from their parents. So there were a lot of children who had endured a lot of separation and loss during that time. And he was working with some juvenile delinquents and noticing that all of them had had very disrupted histories in terms of their attachment figures. And it led him to start to pay attention to the human need for attachment. And attachment is really defined as a human need to be in touch, to make contact with an attachment figure at times of distress, of fear, of illness, of pain. So all kinds of distress signals or endangered lead one to want to seek out an attachment figure. He posited that this is a necessary survival need for the survival of the species, because the human infant is basically helpless. It's not like a little baby mouse who can run to a burrow or something and hide there. Some smaller animals will do their fear response is to go run to a hiding place, but the human infant's fear response is to cling. And to cry and to cling and to engage in these attachment behaviors, to be in contact with a caregiver who can presumably protect and take care of them. And this is a basic human need. Now, he and especially his colleague Mary Ainsworth began to study this systematically. It is to this day perhaps the most impressive body of research in psychology ever. And she went about doing some very interesting and complicated experiments, first in Uganda, because she happened to be stationed there with her husband, and then in Baltimore, Maryland. And then meanwhile, since that time, these studies have been replicated all around the world over and over again. But she basically observed mothers and infants in their home, and then she created what she called a strange situation for the mother and child in a lab. And the mother and child come to the lab, and there's some toys there. They videotape the mother and child together with the toys. How does the child interact during that time? Then a stranger comes in and mother leaves the room. The videotape watches what the child does when mother leaves, and then eventually mother returns, and they watch the reunion behavior. And they found, looking at the child's behavior, that children fall into like four different major categories and of attachment style. The first is a secure attachment style. The securely attached infant cries, first of all, explores the room comfortably when mother's there, cries and protests when mother leaves. Upon reunion, the child runs to mother, wants to be picked up and held. This is a one-year-old, by the way. Mm-hmm. And calms down quickly and is able to then resume exploring when the mother's there. So the child is distressed upon mother's departure, but comforted easily on mother's return. That's the securely attached child. Now, they found that there were three kinds of insecurely attached children. The first is called avoidantly attached, and this child, as they come into the room, this child immediately begins playing with the toys. And as the mother leaves the room, this child continues to play with the toys as if mother never left, as if the child isn't even noticing that the mother left. When mother returns to the room, the child still plays with the toys as though mother never returned. So the initial thought was, well, are these just particularly independent children? Are they so independent they aren't bothered by anything? But what they found when they measured these children's heart rate and autonomic responses was that these children were getting, their autonomic responses were rising when mother left the room. And so they were clearly distressed internally, but they were distracting themselves essentially from being bothered about it behaviorally.
And Dr. Mayhew, what do you mean by autonomic response?
Oh, I mean our internal system, which nervous system, which includes heart rate, it includes galvanic skin response. It's our whole, it's kind of the fight flight response.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
Mm-hmm. And so these children, the avoidantly attached children, were actually, what was found was that these children are basically children connected to mothers who really do not really like the child's bids for attachment. These mothers will pick up and hold their children just as often as the mothers of the securely attached children, but they don't do it when the baby asks for it. In other words, they don't respond to the baby's cry by picking them up. They pick them up at other times. So these children learn, essentially, that to ensure the closest proximity to these parents, they need to pretend they don't need them, essentially. And you can picture, now see, these are attachment patterns that are already consistent by the age of 1 year, before the child even has spoken language. So what happens then, if you can picture this, is that these fundamental patterns, unless there's some way that they become changed, which is they're fairly stable over the course of a lifetime, unless there's, therapy or other things to make a change in them, these patterns continue then on as the person grows up. And so the avoidantly attached person is often somebody, as soon as they begin to feel an interpersonal need, like a need for somebody, a vulnerability, that's frightening for that person. Mm-hmm. For that person, the automatic go-to response then is distract, go do something else, change the subject. And so this accounts, I think, for a lot of times, I think we often see it when we do couples therapy, so one or the other partner who is always sort of distracting, pulling away, distancing from efforts to engage, to find, to be vulnerable together, because there's an automatic kind of responding there that is unconsciously guiding this person in how they live.
Right, and then they don't question it either. They just figure, okay, well, this is the way that I am. Mm-hmm. So accept me for what I am and don't try to change me. Mm-hmm. But, it's interesting, too. I work at a domestic violence shelter, and I can definitely see all of this, the different attachment personalities come through. And I see a lot of avoidant children. Mm-hmm. With their mothers, because they're in residential housing for about 30 to 45 days with us, and I see this over and over again, and sometimes it's pretty frightening. And and where it gets to the point where, especially if it's a baby, mm-hmm. and they are asking for attention, they're crying and they're screaming, and mom is just busy in her own head and in her own pain. And it's heartbreaking to watch these situations happen. We try to help, we try to point it out, we try to educate them and change they're patterning without judging them and making them feel guilty about what their patterning is, because they probably grew up in the same sort of households. They're just carrying out what they know.
Yes. Yeah. Such a good point. And we might, we might imagine that that the avoidance style would be almost or maybe even a dissociative style would be necessary to endure such a difficult living circumstance. And so it makes sense that it's hard for them to kind of break that pattern, disrupt that pattern.
Right. So what do you think in general breaks that patterning?
Well, I think that, I mean, this is, I think, where depth therapy comes in, actually, that, we can do a lot of things with more quick kinds of alternatives, but sort of even recognizing one's fundamental patterns when they're that deep and that automatic really requires some kind of devoted exploration, I think. And we can sort of identify some things fairly quickly, but then also to change that. So, for example, somebody avoidantly attached, it might be really getting to the point of being able to recognize the anxiety that comes up when there's a bid for that person to reveal neediness or to be vulnerable, to need, desire, yearning. That's a giant leap forward to be able to even recognize that, and then to be able to imagine something different. All of this is very, it really requires a lot of exploration and a safe feeling interpersonal environment too.
Right. So in other words, maybe the person starts to become, it becomes really uncomfortable for them to keep going in the same way that they've been going for so long.
Right.
And they start questioning, okay, well, what is it within me that's stopping what I really want? What's stopping me getting what I need? Not what I want, but what I need. Because I know most of us can claim that we didn't have perfect parents, period. That's mm-hmm. just life. There's no manual for parenting. And to be able to go and ask for what you want within a relationship, go find healthy people to be around, can sometimes be terrifying because it's the fear of the unknown.
Yeah, and the other part of it is that we all carry these kind of unconscious scripts about how we are and how others are with us, and what you're talking about is expanding the sense of possibility,
mm-hmm.
and that's essentially so important, when we don't even realize we're in a box.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there a way for us to get reattached as adults?
I think so. And I think that's, I do want to talk about a couple the other two attachment categories too. Should we do that first?
And sure.
Then
yeah. And then we can, definitely. We can come back to that last
okay.
question.
So another insecure category is a different, I'm returning to the one-year-old baby now in the reunion with the mother.
Okay.
It's called ambivalent resistance. So this child comes in with the mother, does not play with the toys very readily, kind of clings to mother, is cautious about the toys, is cautious about sort of leaving her side. And when mother leaves, this child really has difficulty, protests loudly, cries, cannot be comforted by somebody else. And when mother returns, the child has a very hard time being comforted by mother as well. So the child continues to protest. It's the kind of child who, will go, pick me up, and then as soon as he or she's in mother's arms, pushes away and wants to be put down, and then pick me up, put me down. And so you can see the ambivalent, resistant part of that. And so these children are children who grow up to be very, very anxious, and these are children of parents who are there inconsistently. So sometimes the parent is there meeting the attachment needs, and sometimes the parent isn't. And so the theory is that these children up the ante and keep it up in order to be sure to enlist the response of an attachment figure, because they're always having to worry about whether they're going to get it. And so you can picture these people as adults feeling always anxious about whether, in fact, they're going to be, you know, responded to, whether there's going to be somebody there caring about them, and whether they can expect to have the influence that they want to have to get what they need.
And as school-age children, now in this category, wouldn't it be also that a lot of the children that are labeled as troublemakers and brats are in this category?
Actually, it's really interesting. That's a very interesting question, because the way they, and the wonderful thing is there's this amazing longitudinal research project in Minnesota. They've been actually studying children from before birth all the way, now they're in their 30s, these people, and they were able to observe them in school as well and to get teacher rankings and so on. And what they found was that the avoidantly attached kids were the victimizers on the playground. The ambivalent resistant kids were the victims, and the securely attached kids stayed out of it. They just weren't in the middle of that. They were just, you know, they had their own, they were secure enough to not be engaged with that. So it's really interesting what gets played out, how it gets played out over and over again.
So do you think that there are any schools that incorporate this kind of attachment learning and theory into their curriculum, and can I identify the children who are the bullies and the victims and hopefully get in to intervene because they understand what this attachment is about?
That's a really good question. I'm not aware of any schools that are specifically set up that way, except perhaps the one that's connected with the research project, but then they were more trying to study it rather than intervene. But it's an interesting question. And, of course, when we think about attachment, we're trying to intervene at a couple levels, aren't we? We're trying to intervene with the parents, hopefully, so that the parents can think about their children's needs differently. Well, and this usually often involves the parents being willing and able to open themselves up a little bit.
Hopefully.
To understanding themselves, because what the research finds is that that children grow up to have the same attachment patterns with their children that they were raised with. You know, it's a generational transmission thing. And so the avoidantly attached kids grow up to be adults who are dismissive of attachment needs and who in turn then raise their children to be avoidantly attached. So yes, to interrupt this is certainly something. You know, there are a lot of parenting programs now that really try to work with parents to try to help them, what we call mentalizing, being able to think about their children's needs in ways that help them respond differently. So if an adult, say, is dismissive of attachment needs, they may find themselves irritated with bids for attachment, with the child's distress signals. They may think the child's just trying to get attention. That's a common expression. And feel like the child's manipulating. That's another one. And so these are all ways of thinking about the child that alienate the parent from the child in that moment. And so helping them think, well, maybe the child's coming from a different kind of place. There might be other ways of thinking about the child's behavior can help parents begin to, you know, open up to other sets of ideas that then allow them to respond more empathically, really.
Right, and getting them to see that they see the child more than the school system sees the child, or In my case, I see kids like 30 minutes once a week, and it's just working with the kids. It's not working with the parents or the teachers, but it's just getting the children to learn some social skills that they're not learning in the classroom, but they're being sent to me because of a lot of these attachment issues. And
right.
I can see it in every one of the children. No matter which category that they're in, they're the ones that are getting into trouble because they don't have the skills yet. They don't have the brain maturity yet to be able to deal with what's going on in their environment. Especially, I see this in a lot of kindergartners and first graders. They're the ones that seem to be having the hardest time of trying to, you know, go out into the school system and not be attached to mom and or dad at home or grandma or whatever. And yeah, it's fascinating to see.
Well, and especially coming from homes of domestic violence.
Right.
Because this actually brings us to our fourth category of attachment, and that's the disorganized, disoriented child. Children who are growing up in homes like that can feel terribly, terribly anxious about the welfare of their parents. And so I have worked with people who remember as children, they would, like, going to school meant leaving their parents unsupervised. And we don't think of tiny children as bearing that weight, but they certainly, in their feelings, they do. And so the anxiety about the parent, of course, understandably dominates the picture and can be so consuming for these children, they can't really participate freely in school because they're so worried about what's happening to the parent in their absence. Now, the disorganized, disoriented child is a child who, age one again, is distinguished from the others in this way. This child on reunion with the parent will exhibit some kind of disorganized, conflicted, or disoriented kind of behavior. So, for example, you know, as the securely attached child goes straight to the parent and wants to be picked up, the disorganized child might go toward the parent and suddenly freeze, or might go toward the parent looking away the whole time, or might go toward the parent and then veer off and head toward a corner instead, or might just not go toward the parent at all, might just freeze and stare into space. So the idea about these children is that for whatever reason, these children are frightened by the very same figure that is their source of comfort and safety. So you can only imagine for them the immense amount of conflict that poses, because the attachment needs would have this child going to that parent, but the danger signals are saying, watch out, watch out.
Right. It's very confusing for the child.
Very confusing. And so these children, by the time they're six, these children are managing the parents. These are children who are engaging in different ways of controlling the parents. Some of them are like kindly caretaking of the parents. Oh, are you all right, mommy? Others are kind of harsh and punitive, like the parent, like the harsh punitive parent. You sit down there. But they tend to be children who are now coping by managing these parents or trying to.
Well, yeah, and then they get into school, and then they try to do the same thing with the teachers and
exactly.
the other students. And yeah, I have one little one that's 6 years old that displays that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm. And people don't realize that even in adulthood, they can be called control freaks, and people don't realize that you know, they don't, even the people themselves who are exhibiting this don't realize the roots of this and how absolutely necessary it feels to them because of the potential danger if they don't.
Yeah, but it's so destructive to the people around them, and then it's negative, and people don't want to be hanging around somebody that's like that.
Exactly. And not only that, but these are often people who, as long as these controlling strategies work, they may be okay, but then as soon as something disrupts that, somebody refuses to be controlled or whatever, then what happens is the whole disorganized thing breaks loose. And now this very conflicted back and forth, I want you, I hate you, I want you, I hate you kind of thing starts up. And so then is indeed often very kind of disruptive for the people who are engaged with this person, who then respond, you know, angrily, thereby confirming the person's impression that they're dangerous.
Right. It's a recipe for an abuser.
It's a recipe for an abuser and an abusee.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These are also people who are most prone to dissociation. By the age of 19, they're the most prone to that. So, which makes sense, too, because the baby in such conflict has no alternative except to try to escape through dissociating, through just zoning out, tuning out.
Right. And so what do you work with when you have patients that come in with disassociation mm-hmm. problems and they're trying to sort through this and make sense of it and mm-hmm. trying to heal up from it?
Yeah. Well, dissociation problems can run a gamut from sort of the ordinary dissociations of everyday life, like if you or I drive past our freeway exit because we're lost in thought, that's like a really simple daily kind of dissociation, all the way to people with what used to be called multiple personality disorder, where they have literally different personality states that take over and that may have absolutely no idea of the existence of the other states. And so it's important, you know, and then there's the whole gamut in between of different degrees of dissociation. So in working with them, one of the most important things that I hold in mind is that what really is, obviously one of the most important things has to do with continuing to build and address a sense of safety to the greatest degree possible, and then to begin to recognize what danger is like for this person. Because often for this person, danger shows up in ways we wouldn't imagine. And so we just think we're doing something completely ordinary, and it's feeling very threatening for somebody like this, possibly. So, again, there's the trauma trigger going on. So we may trigger dangerous responses for people like this inadvertently. And so helping to begin to untangle that, unpack it, understand it, so that the person themselves can understand their reactivity. In terms of dealing with multiple personality states, it's important to help all the states feel like they have a relational home, that they have a voice, and that all voices are respected, basically, no matter what. And each personality state deserves to be known and understood. And then ultimately, through that, there are techniques I won't get into, but the person can move toward a much more integrated sense of themselves. And even if they still have different states, the states can be functioning in an integrated way so that they aren't always feeling in danger of being surprised by themselves.
Right, and then realizing that it's a lot of coping mechanisms just for survival's sake, because they had to, just out of being a resilient person, they had to come up with some kind of a way to deal with the situation as they best understood it at the time. And having that realization for the person, I think, is just tremendous, because it relieves that guilt and shame and any other negative state they may be feeling about, wow, well, why did I do this? Why did I react like that? Because most people don't know anything else at the moment. They're just trying to survive.
That is such a good point. Exactly. The shame and the confusion of that. And so often people feel like, oh, it's just me. I'm just a hothead. I'm just reactive, without really realizing that it all actually does make sense when we really understand deeply enough.
Right. And Dr. Mayhew, as we are wrapping up the last 5 minutes of the program, is there anything else you would like to add into our conversation?
Well, I think, you know, I think we've really covered a lot of it, but I guess maybe it would be useful then to speak to the intersection of trauma and attachment here. And so one of the things, you know, it's rare. I think we can talk about, in some ways, we can talk about trauma for virtually everyone. And it's really more a matter of degree and kind than it is whether or not. And if we think about these different attachment styles, and then if we add in some other specific trauma, we can see that there's kind of an intersection of how someone might deal with something. And I guess sort of the gist of what I would like to communicate is an appreciation for the complexity of it all, that there aren't predictable, categorical ways of being or ways of thinking about people. Everybody is a unique person, and everybody has a very unique story. And, you know, we have this kind of bedrock of attachment pattern early on, and then things happen. There may be particular qualities of that person's growing up. Let's say there was a favored sibling, not them, and so they always feel less than. Or let's say they were the favored sibling and they feel guilty and estranged from others because of it. You know, there's a multitude of possible relationship patterns that might have existed in the family. And then if we add on traumas like a car accident, serious illness, loss of a loved one, all of that, you know, all the loss of a job, all the kinds of failure in school, all the kinds of millions of traumatic things that can happen to people. There's a very complex patterning of reactions to it that varies with each individual, but it's very important, I think, and extremely useful to be able to understand all of that and how these different things play in juxtaposition to one another.
Yeah, and I think, too, just being able to appreciate when you are going through a trauma, mm-hmm. that yes. you probably have some kind of method of dealing with it at the moment. Mm-hmm. And then just getting to the point where you can get on your two feet a little bit, and then yeah. going out and asking for help, either from family or friends, or if you don't feel comfortable talking to them about it, going and talking to a counselor about it, and dealing with it as soon as you possibly can, because the longer you put it off, the harder it is to work through it, and the longer it takes to heal up from that.
I think that is such a good point, and you are so right. I agree with you completely, because often, you know, people who have been raised, especially with the stiff upper lip kind of child rearing, feel like, well, they should just be able to take it and not be bothered by these right. things. It seems so small. I mean, often it seems like, well, this is just a little pothole in the road. Don't be so thrown off by it. But you know what? If somebody's thrown off by it and finds themselves, you know, really in pain over it, feeling reactive, it's because there's some reason for that. That's because it's related to something triggering something. It's feeling traumatic for that person, even if it doesn't meet the formal criteria for trauma.
Right, and then you need to honor it and heal up from it.
Exactly.
No matter how minute somebody else may think it is, it's yours to deal with. So I think that's really an important idea. And Dr. Mayhew, if the listeners would like to contact you, where can they do so?
I can be, shall I give you my phone number? I can be reached by phone.
Or email.
My phone number is 310-207-9902. I can be reached by email at cwmayhew, that's M-A-Y-H-E-W, @gmail.com.
And thank you so much, Dr. Carol Mayhew. It was a very interesting subject today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And if the listeners would like to contact me, my phone number is 562-234-4650. And my email is jgood8@verizon.net. I do counseling down in Newport Beach, California. So please reach me if you would like to have counseling or you would like to make a comment or suggestion for Psych One-on-One. Really appreciate you being with us. Psych One-on-One is on every Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on SkidRowStudios.com. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.